Now, this is interesting timing because 2 weeks ago I applied for an age pension. But I've had a fantastic career, so I'd like to share with you how I got into it, a lot of things that I learned, and how it connects with my Christian faith. Go. I'm trying to make it unblank. Press B. No, that made the presentation blank. Now, let's see if this little gadget's doing it. Okay. So, my parents were very active in the Methodist Church. I was christened in the Methodist Church and also in the Catholic Church to keep my grandmother happy as well. And I went to Sunday school from a very early age. So I had a good Christian education. I enjoyed Sunday school. For my parents, obedience was really, really important. And the worst thing in a child was confidence. Now, I was born in Sydney, but we moved to country New South Wales. So at the age of 12, I was sent off to boarding school. When I got to boarding school, I was very immature. I was lacking in confidence, totally lacking in confidence, had no self-esteem. And I just didn't fit into boarding school. By the age of 15, I actually decided that life wasn't worth living. And then something interesting happened. Two of my friends in the boarding school found out that the Crusader group was going on a weekend away. And this was a great way to get out of the boarding school for a weekend. So we signed up. Now, for some strange reason I don't understand, they didn't go. But I did. So out in the bush, beautiful place north of Sydney at Galston Gorge, I was sitting on a rock and I discovered the love of God. And it made such a difference to me. Okay, end of the next year, which was my fourth year, I was 16 by then, we were asked what subjects we wanted to do in our final 2 years of school, because this would determine what courses we could get into university and therefore what our future was. So it's a pretty big decision. And I was asking God, what do you want me to do with my life? Anyway, in the Christmas holidays, my dad had been to a Rotary meeting where the speaker had been talking about the work of FAO, that's the Food and Agriculture Organisation, and he had a pamphlet, a booklet, that he thought I might be interested in. Well, I was inspired. This was going to be my mission in life, to go and solve the world protein shortage by teaching poor countries to raise livestock, in particular cattle. So I studied hard and I got into Sydney Uni with the intention of studying vet science, which was 5 years long. But then I discovered that Sydney Uni offered a 4-year course in agriculture, majoring in animal husbandry. Now, 5 years looked an awfully long time to me, so this was more attractive. And anyway, animal husbandry was probably more appropriate to what I was planning to do than vet science. So I studied agriculture. While I was studying, I met another student who was a couple of years older than me. He had similar aspirations. And at the end of 1994, Bruce and I were married. Sorry, 1974. I still had a year to go. When I graduated the following year, Bruce still had 2 years of his teaching contract, so I went job hunting. That wasn't easy for a girl with a degree in agriculture, but I was offered a scholarship to do research with the poultry industry. So I took that up. It just about sent me out of my tree, feeding all these poor little hens in nasty little cages. And then when I was encouraged to apply for a job working for Ingham's, I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life, thank you. So I jumped ship and went back to university to study nutrition and dietetics. This was my 8th year of study. Not bad for a girl who didn't think she could cope with 5 years. I learnt a lot in nutrition and dietetics, and particularly learnt that the world protein shortage was a myth. It was based on the assumption that everybody around the world needed as much protein as they ate in the USA. And as you can see from those numbers, that meant that the majority of countries in the world were protein deficient. But as I say, it was a myth. The truth was that people only needed less than 50 grams of protein a day, and that really meant that only the very poor countries were protein deficient. But a much bigger problem was simply the shortage of food. There were a lot of countries around the world that just didn't have enough food to eat. So the challenge was to increase the overall food supply. Mind you, some people already had more than they needed. As you can see from this map, the ones in dark red had more food than they needed. The ones in dark orange had plenty. The ones in light orange had about enough. The ones in yellow were a bit short. And the ones in the creamy colour, there was starvation going on. Anyway, Bruce finished his contract, and he got a job with AusAid teaching agriculture in the Solomon Islands. Yay, we were on our way to going around the world and solving their problems. I finished my dietetics degree and followed him up a few months later. I found that I wasn't particularly welcome because he was having a good time with the single girls up there. So there were cracks starting to show in our marriage. But I really enjoyed living in Solomon Islands. The people were lovely. I enjoyed going down to the markets and buying the local food. And I took up work as a volunteer dietitian in the local hospital, which was a very interesting experience. I could see some cracks developing, though. The local people were complaining about how the cattle that had been brought in by the Australian Aid Organisation were invading their vegetable gardens and eating their vegetables, and as far as they were concerned, the cattle were a nuisance. I could also see a problem where imported unhealthy food was starting to invade the local diet. The problem was that anything that was imported was regarded as superior to that which was locally produced, and the term him local meant that's second best. So the kids were getting into things like ice blocks. Anyway, at the end of the year, I was offered a paid job teaching nutrition in the School of Nursing. However, Bruce wanted more money. They said no, so he said, we're going back to Australia. So that's what happened. And I got a job working in Queanbeyan in New South Wales, which is snuggled right up near the... There's the ACT, that little white patch, and there's Queanbeyan. So we bought a house, lived in Canberra, and I joined home church, which I really enjoyed. But Bruce and I were going our separate ways. He was spending a lot of time away on weekends and wouldn't tell me where he was. And then he got another job with AusAid, this time working in China. And when I said, well, can I come too? He said, no, you'd be a nuisance. So we went our separate ways. Now, for me, Canberra was too cold. I wanted to go somewhere warmer. So I got a job in Port Hedland. 198 kilometres from Marble Bar. I didn't realise where it was, I just knew it was north somewhere, and it was probably warmer than Canberra, which was well and truly right. But I really did enjoy working in the Pilbara, and I grew up. I learned to do all sorts of things. I gained confidence, etc. Then in 1990, I was offered the opportunity to do some research with the Medical Research Foundation at Royal Perth Hospital, and the idea was that I would get my PhD. And I also met Bevan at that time. However, the funding for the research project was not renewed, so my PhD fell in a heap. And in 1991, I got a job as a diabetes coordinator, diabetes education coordinator, and I stayed in that job till 94. Also in 1994, Bevan and I got married. And I also started working as a diabetes dietitian at Bentley Hospital in 2001. So that was my diabetes phase. In 1994, I was transferred to the public health unit to work as a public health nutritionist. And I discovered the term food security, which is what I'd been interested in all along. It was about people having enough food, excuse me, but also in a way that maintained human dignity. So not begging, stealing, or getting it from aid organisations. And I worked on a project to improve food security in Aboriginal communities, which was really good fun. Then in 2008, I was invited to do some lecturing in public health nutrition at Curtin Uni. It was interesting. I had a class of 64 students, and two of them came from Perth. The rest of them came from all over the world, and I put up a map of the world and asked them to put a sticker on where... Excuse me. A sticker on where they came from, and this is what it looked like. And when I looked at it, I went, wow, they're all the countries that I was actually planning to go to fix their nutrition problems. And now they've come to me to learn about nutrition to go home and implement those things. Isn't God amazing? I also learned a lot, and nutrition had changed a great deal in those, 30 years since 78 when I graduated. The food supply problem had very much diminished. There weren't nearly so many countries who were short of food. As you can see, the actual food availability had increased markedly, but not fairly. So some countries had just enough, and other countries had way more than they needed. And you can see that in this map too. The dark red are the people who've actually got about 150% of their needs of food. The ones in the pale pink are the only ones who don't have enough. Or you can see it in the graph how the... But you can also see how this is bringing in another health problem. And particularly in the countries who've got way too much, overweight has become a very severe health problem with all the things that have got consequences after it. In particular, obesity, which is the severe form of overweight, is particularly bad in the wealthy countries. And that in turn means that diabetes has become a world epidemic. We call it a growth industry. Now back in 1980, you can see that the diabetes prevalence is about proportional to how wealthy countries are. So the poor countries have got the lowest prevalence and the wealthy countries have got more. But it's changing. As you can see above 2014, the wealthy countries have now got the least amount of diabetes, and that's only relative, but the poorest countries are the ones where diabetes is growing the fastest. What is this all about? This graph shows how the increase in the food supply is matched by the increase in fat supply and protein. The fat in particular, that's the red line, has gone up very rapidly, and a lot of it is from oilseed crops. The other part of it is both the protein and the fat have gone up from increasing production of meat. So this one shows that really there is no protein shortage anywhere in the world. There may be individuals within countries who are short of protein for various reasons, but as a country, there isn't a country anymore that is protein deprived. And this graph shows how the protein supply has increased, again, mainly in the wealthy countries. And this shows how unfairly protein is distributed across the world. The darker the blue, the more protein people eat. Oops. And as I say, it's mainly about an increase in the meat supply. So they did manage to increase their protein without my help and through having more meat. The fat supply has also increased greatly, and once again you can see, but it's not fairly distributed, as this graph shows. And the map also shows it. Now, can you see a pattern here? Excess food, excess fat, excess protein, obesity, and diabetes coming up. Interestingly, although the grain supply has almost doubled in the time that the population has doubled, the grain supply per head, per person, is actually diminishing. And it's a little bit the same with potatoes. So the story that the bread and potatoes are causing the weight problems, I'm yet to be convinced. And you can see with the potatoes that the wealthy countries are actually having less, whereas the poorer countries do have more. So the overall supply is staying much the same, but the consumption of potatoes as fries has skyrocketed. So that's not really a good story. So now we have a paradox. We have solved the world food shortage, and yet we've now got all sorts of health problems caused by our abundance. Why is this? Well, we used to buy our food in markets. We bought lots of fruit and veg from the market, as you saw in the Solomons. We went to the baker for our bread. We went to the fish market for our fish, and we went to the butcher for our meat. This is how we shop today. Food has become a big industry. Now have a close look at these numbers. Food production in Australia in 2013 was worth $42.8 billion. Processing was worth $84.9, nearly twice. And $141 billion for retail. So you can see where the money is in the food industry, and it's not in actually producing food. This end. We also export basic food like grains and meat and dairy products. Look at our biggest import, beverages. And this shows our exports and imports. This one's unprocessed food. You can see that we export a lot of unprocessed food and we import very little. Whereas in this graph, you can see we also export some processed food, but we're importing more and more. And these are the main things that we're importing. Soft drink, cordial, and syrup. And the syrup is mainly used to make soft drink. Has anybody seen the big Coca-Cola factory out near Midland? It's huge, and what they do is import the syrup, mix it with water and bubbles and put it in cans, and therefore it's made in Australia. We also have bakery products, cakes, biscuits, pastries, confectionery, and some processed fruit and vegetables. More and more, our food supply is controlled by the multinationals. And that, in turn, is driven by advertising. And I'm not just talking about television and magazines. There's toys, there's games, there's websites, social media, sports sponsorship, sponsoring various schools' activities. We're not aware of it because it is everywhere. The problem is that advertising targets our emotional and subconscious. It gives us a desire for these things that we're not conscious of. So like the rider on the elephant, our conscious brain says, these foods aren't good for us. We should be eating healthy alternatives. But the elephant itself underneath says, oh no, this is what I'm going to do. So people eat the foods and feel guilty about them. So it ends us up with this bind that I go to a party and I hear it every time. I shouldn't be eating this, but it's yummy. So now we've got this dilemma of good food and bad food, and we feel guilty about the bad food, but it's not solving the problem. And this is being reinforced. We hear the media, we hear all sorts of organisations, politicians saying people should take responsibility and not eat unhealthy food. Parents should take responsibility and stop their children from eating junk. And yet we've got this constant drive to eat the stuff coming from the advertising. And a little while ago I heard an argument about taxing the sugary drinks. And the Grocery Council said, oh no, it's not about taxing and regulation, it's about education. And I thought about that for a minute and thought, yes, they're right. We should stop educating people about consuming things that aren't healthy. Look at the money that is spent on advertising these things. Whoops. $2 billion US spent on advertising McDonald's around the world. That is actually more money than it costs to run the World Health Organization. Coca-Cola sells enough cans of Coke for 25% of the population to have a can every day. And somebody's drinking mine because I don't like the stuff. How often do you see these things advertised? And the problem is that it's the processed foods, as you saw in that earlier slide, where the money is. So of course they're the foods that are advertised. You get far more if you spend $100 on the basic foods than if you spend $100 on the processed foods. But people are not aware of it because the processed foods are sold in smaller packages. So it's all about the fact that our food supply is now run by a great God dollar. And when I first started lecturing, there were warnings that this was going to happen, that fat was going to be the new tobacco. Just the same as the tobacco industry got up to all sorts of tricks to cover up the damage that their product was doing and to resist regulation. So they were saying that the food industry was going to be doing the same. They sponsor sport, they sponsor school activities, they pay health professionals to say that there's no evidence to support the damage. They sponsor health professionals to go to conferences. They sponsor health professionals to do research to prove that there's no harm. And they have the money to publicise these things. I've actually got a letter at home from Coca-Cola saying, dear dietitian, and telling me that the problem in increasing overweight in children had nothing to do with sugary soft drinks. It was because they weren't doing enough physical activity, and therefore they were sponsoring physical activity programs in schools. if you do the numbers on the food, the calories in and the calories out, the kids have got to do physical activity 36 hours a day. So we need to learn lessons from the tobacco industry. How do we deal with this? The problem is food is much harder than tobacco. Tobacco is one product and everybody knows it's harmful. Food has got so many different combinations and permutations, and we do need certain foods. So it is much harder to regulate the food supply. There's just one example of how the food industry will sponsor a health professional to say something that flies in the face of all the evidence that's gone before. And I actually remember one of my classmates being on television, having been sponsored by the sugar industry to say there's no evidence that sugar causes overweight in children. And I went, Peter, how could you? So you can see that the media has a huge amount to do with this. And we know that the wealthy countries are really keen on trade agreements. That's because they benefit so much. This slide shows who benefits and who suffers from the world trade. The ones in green are the ones who have a positive balance of trade when it comes to food, and the ones in yellow are the ones that are negative. And this is having a really bad effect on the economy and the nutritional status of the people in the poor countries. So, for example, you can see in Thailand, they're producing more and more rice and eating less and less of it. And in Kenya, they're producing more and more vegetables and eating less and less of them. What do you think they're eating instead? Because their fat intake and their protein intake is going up. I find this slide shocking. These are trucks, and the green stuff are apples being dumped, because if they put them on the market, it would increase the price of apples, and we can't have that. Incredible wastage, so deliberate wastage of good food. And wastage comes in all levels through the food supply, in the production. For example, I don't know how many of you saw the article on bananas being disposed of because they were the wrong shape. Apples get disposed of because they're the wrong colour, the wrong shape, the wrong size, etc. Food is wasted in the transport process, the processing, at retail level. One of my big pains is the best before date. That's something the food industry puts there to encourage you to throw it out and buy another one. If they just put on the date when it was produced, we could decide for ourselves if it's been in the cupboard for too long and we're not going to eat it anyway and throw it out. But we probably wouldn't buy another one under those circumstances because we realise that we've changed our mind, we don't want to eat it. We've also got huge environmental damage being caused by industrial food production. The increase in meat production and the use of machinery is increasing greenhouse gases. We're using a lot more water, water that we don't have, and I'm quite sure you've heard the commotion in the media about our own water supply and the death of the fish in the lakes. And then we package it up in plastic, which we then take off and throw out. And of course there's environmental damage due to the huge amount of travelling that our food does. I know that Coles and Woolworths both have a policy whereby they call it central purchasing. They purchase the products from one company in one place and then transport it all over the country rather than buying locally produced food. So that's why you'll find often that locally produced food like yogurt is more expensive in our supermarkets than the stuff that's come from the eastern states. And we had an interesting discussion in class about meat. As I've mentioned, meat is a problem because of the environmental impact. It's also a problem because of the way meat is produced. Animals are badly treated in our meat production industry. I've seen some horrific videos that are not fit for kids to see about how animals are treated and slaughtered. And I know from what I saw in the poultry industry, it makes me shudder what goes on. So we do have a movement now where eating meat is regarded as maybe not a good thing to do. As I say, we had a big discussion in class. And what does meat mean? Because people love meat. It's sort of a status symbol to eat meat. Is it about domination of another species? There's all sorts of very interesting issues to discuss there. Anyway, I'm now going to show you some pictures of what people do eat around the world, produced by Peter Menzel, now back in 2005, so the numbers are a little bit out of date. You can assume they're higher now, but it's the comparison that I'm interested in. This is what a fairly poor family in the US might eat in a week, and they would pay $341 for it. And this is what a fairly poor family of seven in Australia would eat, and they'd pay $376 US equivalent. This is what a very health-conscious family in Australia would eat, a family of four, $303 US. This is what a family of seven in Mali might eat, worth $26. Now, a lot of people tell me that the reason that some people don't have enough to eat is because their families are too big, and if they would just learn birth control, their problems would be solved. My answer is not polite. There's a family of six in Chad, and as you can see, they're eating very basic food, rice, lentils, and a few vegetables, worth $1.23. Now, if we've got people spending such little amounts of money in some countries and such large amounts in the others, it just shows that food is not fairly distributed. And it doesn't only apply to food. It's about all sorts of resources. It's not fairly distributed. This one shows a little bit more detail. 0.7% of the world's population, that's not even 1%, have 45.9, nearly 50% of the world's resources. And at the bottom end, 70% of the world's population only have 2.7% of the world's resources. And it's getting worse. The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. Now, Oxfam published this information that between 2010 and 2015, the wealth of the richest 62 individuals increased by 44%, while the wealth of the poorest half of the world's population decreased by 41%, to the degree that they actually had the same. So 62 individuals have got the same wealth as half the world's population, which is billions. And that's what it looks like as a graph. Again, this shows how the wealthy are getting wealthier and the poor are not keeping up. So a top-notch CEO, his pay has increased by nearly 1,000%, while the average worker's pay has increased by a little over 10%. And it's the same in Australia. In Australia, turn it around here, I can see better. So 1% of our population owns 20% of our wealth, and 50% of our population owns 10% of our wealth. And we know this isn't right. There are many exhortations to Christians about sharing with the poor. But I'm not trying to send you on a guilt trip. This is a big picture stuff. How do I respond to it? Well, at a personal level, with the food, I eat basically the basic healthy foods, and I try and avoid as far as possible anything produced by the multinationals. Fortunately, that message coincides with what is healthy and necessary, particularly for people with diabetes. So I can give the same advice. And in the last couple of years, I've been working on this online diabetes course, where I've been teaching people all around the world how to manage their diabetes. And of course, the food module is the most popular and the one that creates the most discussion. So I'm sitting at my little desk at home, communicating with people all around the world, particularly the poorer countries, giving them advice on better nutrition. So God truly has given me the desires of my heart. And I'm hoping to continue that this year, even though I'll only be working something like an hour a week. And I'm also hoping to create another online course for health professionals, because I think we can spread the message better if the health professionals are well educated. But I know that this isn't really changing the root cause of the problem. And I feel rather powerless about that. I know it's a big picture thing. It's a spiritual thing. And I have no control over that. It makes us laugh, but that's because it's not funny. For me, this is the answer, but I don't know how it will happen. Okay. Any comments, questions, or complaints? Elise? It depends on which year you were talking about as to how many, but it was about 25%. Mm-hmm. It's at least 50% now.
You talk about red meat, and I know numbers of people where the doctors actually said, eat more red meat for health purposes. So is it, I understand the environmental issues of beef. If we put that aside, it sounded like you thought that red meat carried health problems.
It does, in that if we eat more than we need, it has detrimental effects on our digestive system. I recently did a literature review on the value of eating less meat and more plants, and I was quite surprised to read about the detrimental effects on the digestive system. The reason more meat is recommended is that there are some women who are iron deficient, and meat is a good source of iron. And the reason for that's interesting, that traditionally women were pregnant or breastfeeding most of their lives, so they weren't menstruating. Now in our modern lifestyle, women tend to menstruate regularly and therefore lose blood and therefore become iron deficient. Men very rarely become iron deficient because they don't lose blood. But of course the meat industry has really managed to promote the importance of protein and iron. And I still hear it in the media about, oh, this food's high in protein and that food's high in protein. I think, big deal, we're eating more than we need anyway. So, yes, that applies to some individuals, but it's not a overall population advice?
It's a meat question. My understanding is that a lot of the data and studies about the impact of meat on the environment comes out of the US and the US's farming systems, and that Australia's not as heavily dependent on feedlots or factory farming of red meat. Do you have any information about that, about whether there's any difference about buying Australian meat rather than international meat?
Absolutely, yes. Australian meat is differently produced, and they tend to use land that is not suitable for anything else. Unfortunately, it is going the feedlot way. You often hear meat advertised as feedlot-produced, grain-fed, etc., as if it's something good, and it still doesn't change the fact that we just plain eat too much. Rose? What's the right amount? The average person needs about 50 grams of protein a day. Meat contains about 20% protein, which means, hang on, do the maths, 250 grams, but thanks, thanks, James. So if meat was your only source, but it's actually really hard to be protein deficient because there's protein in just about everything we eat. And with this literature review I did a little bit at the bottom on the practicalities and showed how somebody could very easily meet their protein requirements by only eating 100 grams of meat a day, because the protein comes from all sorts of other foods, and also how a vegetarian can still meet their protein requirements. If we eat meat, we're probably eating at least twice as much protein as we need. But I'm happy to give you a bit more detail and some numbers and some charts and that sort of thing if you want to follow up on that.
I don't know whether it's a good idea, but I tend to rotate red meat, chicken and fish. But sometimes I buy eggs and sometimes I buy eat baked beans. But I have that rotation of one day, you know, the next day.
Good idea. Variety is the spice of life, and variety is also important in nutrition. But again, it's an issue of quantity. Fish used to be more sustainable than meat, but there are issues with that now too. We're beginning to fish out our fish stocks as well. Bobby?
I feel that things aren't perhaps quite as gloomy as you. I felt that after you finished that, because when you look at the change in supermarkets over the last few years, I remember the times when it was almost impossible, for instance, to get free-range eggs. And part of it is people to blame because they don't want to pay that little bit more for something. I mean, for instance, when I go and buy mince now, I always buy mince that says grass-fed beef. You'll look at a lot of it and it'll say grain-fed, and I agree with you, but it's looking for the thing that best meets your ethical beliefs. So I go West Australian and I go free range with anything like that. And the other thing, of course, is simply liking vegetarian food and eating more of it. I thought you were going to say a bit more about what people could actually do to change this, but I think there's loads of things. I mean, I won't buy Italian imported tomatoes, for example. I'll always buy Australian ones, even though they come from the other side of the country. They're still Australian. And actually, I look on packets and see whether it says Australian made from so much percentage imported or so much percentage Australian. And I'm sure at one time they wouldn't have even bothered to put that on the packet. But that's now they know people are interested in how much they're buying as local food, so they'll actually put that on the packet.
You're right, Bobby. But you're a minority. And I used to take people with diabetes around the supermarket and teach them to read labels. And they always used to complain, it takes me so long to do the shopping when I'm looking at the labels. So you are part of the well-educated, aware elite. Certainly it is a move in the right direction, and I've also noticed that there's the takeaway foods have got a lot better. But also in the supermarket I've noticed that there's a lot less plain meat and a lot more meat that's already prepared, cooked, spiced, crumbed, processed in some way. So the convenience food is certainly driving a lot of it in the other direction too.
From terrific slides and so on, so I think you might find yourself busy speaking more than just today. Would you suggest, from your understanding of the psychology of it, that the most effective thing we can do, apart from our own consumption, is to make the good attractive rather than to hammer the negative?
Yep.
To be a voice of this is good for you, yep, for your pocket, for your health, for the world, for everything, and really become very good at demonstrating and propagating that in our community life.
Yeah, but the problem is that there is not really the money available for the advertising. We can't compete. Yeah, at a personal level we certainly can, and that's really why I'm talking to you. And I'm trying to stimulate some ideas as to how we can respond, because I don't have all the answers. So Bobby, you're saying you're hoping I'd give you some answers. I'm hoping that you'll come up with some thoughts and ideas yourselves. I think maybe even writing to politicians about certain issues might be constructive. And you might have got any bright ideas. What was that about a fish pond, Paul?
I'm wondering if you could give us a list of the things we need to make.
It's easy. Anything produced by a multinational. I think you know. I think you know what the areas of concern are.
Well, you had mentioned potatoes. What's the problem with potatoes?
Potatoes are fine. It's just if you chop them up and deep fry them, there's more oil than potato in it.
So it's the processed form.
Yep. Actually, as I say, I use this. I use it all the time. It's the basic five food groups, which have been produced. This pamphlet has been produced and there's no money to promote it. And people say it's not working. Well, how does it work when it's got to compete against a $2 billion advertising budget?
Tricia, would you read us what the five groups are, because I can't actually determine it from here.
Have you seen this before?
I probably have, but
okay.
I would like to be reminded what the five groups are.
Okay, the idea is that we eat in proportion of the circle. So this is supposed to represent your day's food. About what, a quarter fruit, vegetables, another eighth of fruit, a third bread, rice, pasta, grain foods, a small amount of meat, chicken, fish, eggs, or vegetarian equivalents like lentils, etc. And a small amount of dairy products, milk, yogurt and cheese. These are the foods we need to take care of. Now, we're not saying you never ever eat them, but traditionally humans created treat foods for special occasions, and they were lovingly made with the best of ingredients, and I know we've got some fantastic cooks in this church for special occasions. Now they're just mass-produced and we're told we should be eating them every day. We're saying we should be eating them occasionally for special occasions. And the other one is drink water, not things out of a can. Even water out of a bottle is environmentally not so great, but it's better than Coke out of a bottle. Any other questions? I'll just show you the next pamphlet too, because the next question is always how much, and this pamphlet shows how many serves of various groups of the population, like men and women of various age groups and children and all that sort of thing. And as I say, I use this all the time in diabetes education. And I tell people there's no such thing as a diabetic diet. They just follow the basic guidelines.
Will this be available on the website?
Do you want it on the website?
Yes.
Okay.
Trish, just your view on diets.
Sorry?
Your view on diets.
Diets are for people who've got a metabolic problem like phenylketonuria or Crohn's disease or something like that, where there's something that they can't tolerate. I certainly don't recommend diets for weight reduction. In fact, what we try and do is once we've given people the basic information about what is healthy food, we then try and get them to identify their food habits, because most people have got habits that they know are sabotaging them, and work out how to change those habits. It's a slow process, and it doesn't give you a magic loss of 5 kilos in a month, but it works long term, because it's about changing habits, the things you do every day. I tell people to put it on slowly, so you've got to get it off slowly to keep it off.